Today is Friday, July 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, two major Supreme Court rulings on President Trump's finances that, despite some legal experts, the White House touts as a win.
The Vance majority laid out a roadmap for the president. The Vance majority said the president has the right to challenge the subpoena on any grounds permitted by state law.
With 115 days until the presidential election, Joe Biden accuses Trump of ignoring the pandemic.
The guy who says I'm commander in chief and then doesn't command anything in this fight against the COVID.
Also ahead, the Rolling Stones plan to release never-before-heard tracks that include other rock legends. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday firmly rejected President Donald Trump's arguments for sweeping presidential immunity and ruled that a New York prosecutor can obtain his financial records, but it for now prevented the Democratic-led House of Representatives committees from getting similar documents. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany in a news conference Thursday disputed either ruling as a loss for the president.
The justices did not rule against him. In fact, it was a unanimous opinion saying that this needs to go back to the district court.
Joining us now for legal analysis, Joel Paul, professor at the UC Hastings Law School in San Francisco. Thanks so much for being with us. Explain exactly what happened and what is significant about these two 7-2 rulings authored by conservative Chief Justice John Roberts.
Well, in the first case, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected the president's arguments that his financial documents were entitled to absolute immunity from a state criminal court's jurisdiction. And that means that the New York grand jury can now receive those documents from his bank and his accountant, and they will have an opportunity to go through those documents. The president still has whatever defenses he wants to assert in the court, but he doesn't have any special defenses because he's president. And in the second case, the court considered the president's argument that Congress lacked the authority to compel the release of his financial documents. And in that case, the court agreed to send the case back to a lower court to consider whether the release of the documents to the House of Representatives would violate separation of powers issues.
Why did they agree on the case with the state of New York and push back on the other one?
Well, in the state of New York case, they had a unanimous agreement as to the question of whether or not the president had any sort of special absolute immunity. In the second case, it's a more complicated case. It's actually a very subtle case. The issue there really is how much necessity did Congress have to show to entitle them to receive the documents? And really, there too, the court was more or less unanimous that Congress has very broad investigative authority, that they can receive documents, they can demand documents from the president. The only question there that divided the court between the seven justices in the majority and the two in the dissent was how much necessity they had to show. So I would say, taking those two cases together, that this was really a very significant loss for the president.
Because he was basically told that because he's the president, he's subject to the same laws as the American public, basically?
This is a strong victory for the rule of law and for the assertion of judicial independence. That's what this is about. This is really the court saying that they are independent of the president and that they're going to hold him to the same standard as every other American. There's a significant line in Justice Roberts' opinion. He says, in our judicial system, the public has a right to every man's evidence. And I think it's that principle that the court is really enforcing in these cases.
A lot of people were really waiting and anticipating the court's ruling in hopes to finally see the president's taxes that he has so far worked very hard to keep secret. But it sounds like the documents in the first ruling are going to a grand jury, not public. And Congress obviously will probably still work at whatever investigations they are conducting. Is it safe to say it's unlikely that the public will actually be able to see the president's tax returns before the upcoming presidential election?
It's very unlikely that we will see any of these documents before the election. The grand jury will not release the documents once they receive them. The only way those documents might become public is if there is an indictment that follows from them. And as far as the other case goes, the Congress is going to have to demonstrate a sufficient need for them to receive the documents. In the case before the Supreme Court, the congressional committees did not make a very convincing case. But I do think that at least the Intelligence Committee in the House might have a strong argument for getting the documents, and they could release the documents, but that would have to be after the election. What I think about the case that's so interesting is it's clear to me that the Chief Justice here has managed to weave together a consensus on the court, which a lot of people thought was impossible. And he's done it, I think, by making some concessions to the conservatives on the court in the second case, the case involving Congress, and making other concessions to the liberals on the court in the case involving the grand jury. And so he's been able to cobble together a nearly unanimous decision in both cases. That's an extraordinary achievement, and I think it represents real statesmanship on his part.
It also certainly seems to send a message to the American people that we do have a Constitution and we have a Supreme Court that, regardless of who nominated them, Democrat or Republican, they are looking at the legalities and not the politics.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think for those of us who are concerned about what might happen in the coming election, the Supreme Court has let us know that they are independent and that they are not a political animal and that they're not necessarily under the control of the White House. They're independent and they will make decisions for themselves.
Joel Paul, professor at the UC Hastings Law School in San Francisco. The World Health Organization said Thursday it is setting up an independent panel to review its handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the response by governments, while not mentioning any particular country. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus urged the world to stand in solidarity in fighting the pandemic.
This cannot be another blue ribbon panel that issues a report that goes up on the bookshelf. We must come together in a global conversation to take these hard-won lessons and turn them into action.
The announcement follows strong criticism by President Donald Trump's administration and the U.S. formal notification Tuesday that it was withdrawing from the U.N. agency. Tedros also noted that the crisis has brought opportunity.
COVID-19 has taken so much from us, but it's also giving us an opportunity to break with the past and build back better. I want us to see this as opportunity. It's a crisis, but opportunities are born from crisis.
Meanwhile, the WHO is acknowledging the possibility that COVID-19 might be spread in the air under certain conditions. Studies evaluating the novel coronavirus outbreaks in restaurants, choir practices, and fitness classes suggest the virus may have been spread in the air. Record-breaking rises in coronavirus cases and deaths in several U.S. states are dimming hopes of a quick economic recovery. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden Thursday accused President Trump of ignoring the pandemic at the expense of the economy and American lives.
The storm we're facing today is unlike any we've seen in our lifetimes. More than 130,000 people dead because of the coronavirus.
Speaking in Pennsylvania to the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Biden introduced an ambitious economic agenda while drawing a contrast with the current billionaire president, who he said has abandoned working-class Americans and encouraged division amid a national reckoning with systemic racism.
Toughest challenge we've ever faced. We need to repair the lines that have been severed between the American people. We need to restore power to workers, to communities, been denied so long.
Vice President Mike Pence Thursday was also in Pennsylvania, speaking to potential voters where he cast Biden as a threat to the economy. Congressional Democrats continue to push for answers this week on media reports that Russia paid bounties to Taliban-linked militants for the deaths of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Those reports that President Donald Trump and some Republicans have said are unverified have highlighted the difficulty of confronting Russia in an election year. For details on the hearing, I spoke to VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. It sounds like Secretary of Defense Mark Esper's statements are in line with the White House in that he said he wasn't informed about the intelligence.
Well, basically what the Secretary of Defense is telling U.S. lawmakers is that, well, he wasn't specifically briefed on the issue of bounties. He was very specific about that word. That was important and came into play. He did learn about payments to Taliban-linked militants, but that was in an intel briefing that was not corroborated by the Department of Defense. So when we're talking about U.S. government agencies, we really need to drill down on the specifics because these things are important. When the Department of Defense is looking at intelligence, they want to know if it was verified by the Department of Intelligence. And it's these distinctions that the administration has been making to explain why they weren't aware or why they didn't act on that intelligence. So going over to the White House level, the president has said that he wasn't briefed on that intelligence because they felt that it wasn't important for him to learn about it because it hadn't been fully verified. That's something that analysts really pushed back on Capitol Hill on Thursday.
What were some of the main points that Congress was trying to drill down on? Were they specifically asking why Russia hasn't faced any consequences, if in fact this is true?
Absolutely. So that was the main thrust of the congressional Democrats' arguments when they were hearing from some top analysts and experts in the field. They were saying, look, even if this wasn't fully verified, even the fact that this might be happening in the environment is a threat to U.S. interests in Afghanistan and worldwide, and should at least be met with a warning, according to their arguments, from the U.S. to Russia. Congressional Republicans were a little bit dicier on that issue. They felt as though we should be focusing on the fact that if these payments did occur, then we should be looking at the fact that it was the Taliban who was receiving them. And of course, we're actually engaged in peace negotiations with the Taliban to try and end the longest war in U.S. history, that U.S. engagement in Afghanistan. They're saying, look, is this a sign that the Taliban isn't negotiating in good faith? So this really just brings up a host of questions about U.S. engagement in the region.
And still really no clear picture of what, if anything, the U.S. plans to do regarding potentially Russia doing these things. Is that correct?
Well, the former U.S. commander for troops in Afghanistan actually said there is one clear-cut way that the U.S. could send a message to Russia and to Vladimir Putin, and that is that we should not be withdrawing U.S. troops from Germany. That sends a clear message that we are withdrawing from our NATO commitments, that we can let Russia incursion farther and farther into Eastern Europe. This is something that Putin is watching very closely. And as one of the analysts noted in this hearing, Vladimir Putin is a risk taker. And he sees that if he can take a risk like this, if those Russian bounties did in fact occur, then he's going to take even bigger risks next time, having seen the way the U.S. has responded to these reports and stories.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. A UN rights investigator is calling on Saudi Arabia to free women activists before a G20 nations summit, which Riyadh will be hosting in November. At least a dozen prominent women's rights activists were arrested in Saudi Arabia in 2018 as it lifted a ban on women driving cars. Palestinian leaders hope Democrat Joe Biden will tone down Washington's pro-Israel policies if he becomes the next U.S. president. And Palestinian Americans have been pressing his campaign for a change, according to sources familiar with the efforts. New York's mayor joined mask-wearing activists Thursday to paint Black Lives Matter in giant yellow letters on the city's exclusive Fifth Avenue, directly in front of Trump Tower, which was once the crown jewel in President Donald Trump's properties. China's new national security law in Hong Kong has left Australia to resort to some tough measures of its own. AP correspondent Karen Shamas reports.
Some Hong Kong residents, now unhappy with the new restrictions in their hometown, can stay with an extended visa in Australia. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison also made a major announcement about Australia's extradition treaty with China.
Australia today has taken steps to suspend our extradition agreement.
The PM announced a range of visas that will be extended from 2 to 5 years and offers of pathways to permanent residency visas. Critics view the new security legislation in Hong Kong as a further deterioration of freedoms in response to last year's massive protests calling for greater democracy and more police accountability. I'm Karen Chamas.
One of South Korea's most prominent elected officials, Park Won-soon, the longtime mayor of its capital, was found dead by police after being reported missing by his daughter amid a criminal probe of an alleged impropriety. Freddie Joyner has more from Reuters.
Longtime Seoul City Mayor Park Won-soon was found dead, according to police on Friday. This comes after his daughter reported him missing at 5:17 p.m. local time, saying his phone was off and that he had left a message, quote, like a will. Hundreds of police took part in the hours-long search, utilizing both drones and dogs. The Seoul Metropolitan Police Agency said the mayor's body was found at Mount Bugak in northern Seoul around midnight, near where his phone signal had last been detected. The agency did not give a cause of death. A police official told reporters at a television briefing at the scene there was no sign of foul play, although a detailed investigation would be needed. As mayor of the city of nearly 10 million people, Park was one of South Korea's most influential politicians and played a high-profile role in its response to the coronavirus pandemic. He was seen as a potential presidential hopeful for the liberals in the 2022 presidential elections. The Yonhap News Agency said a former secretary of Park had filed a complaint on Wednesday over alleged incidents of sexual harassment. Police said an investigation was underway after a criminal complaint had been lodged against Park, without elaborating. Formerly a prominent human rights activist and lawyer, Park had been the mayor of Seoul since 2011. Pursuing a slew of policies promoting gender equality.
Reuters' Freddie Joyner reporting. The Human Rights Council received a report Thursday on the issue of targeted killings through armed drones. A special investigator accused the United States of having violated international law when it carried out an airstrike that killed Iranian General Qassem Soleimani at the airport in Baghdad, Iraq. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN investigator says the world is awash with drones. Agnes Kalimar says more than 100 nations have an active military drone inventory and about a dozen allegedly have deployed armed drones for the use of force, such as targeted killings. Kalimar says the unbounded and uncontrolled proliferation of armed drones poses a threat to international peace and stability. She says the U.S. killing of Iranian General Qassem Soleimani has elevated the dangers. She notes the U.S. carried out its attack without first obtaining Iraq's consent, thereby violating Iraq's territorial integrity.
That is a significant and troubling new development. It is the first known incident in which a state invokes self-defense as justification for an attack against a government official outside a declared armed conflict.
Kalimar says no evidence has been provided that General Soleimani specifically was planning an imminent attack against U.S. interests, particularly in Iraq, for which immediate action was necessary and would have been justified. Days after the drone attack, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Soleimani had planned a broad, large-scale attack against American interests, and those attacks were imminent. Kalimar warns the U.S. self-defense argument is just a tipping point. She says Turkey has fully accepted the U.S. doctrine, and other countries, including Britain, have expressed their support for it. She tells VOA she fears an increasing number of countries are likely to justify armed drone attacks by invoking the war on terror. She says the United States made this argument regarding the killing of General Soleimani.
So my response to you is that if I were in the shoes of a government or a member of a government who will be deemed a terrorist by the U.S. At this point, I will be very and extra careful.
Calamar says she submitted her report to every country mentioned early in May. She says the U.S. has not engaged with her and has not responded to her report. Earlier this week, State Department spokeswoman Morgan Ortega said it takes a special kind of intellectual dishonesty to issue a report condemning the United States for acting in self-defense while whitewashing General Soleimani's notorious past as one of the world's deadliest terrorists. The Iranian ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Esmael Baghail Hamansh, called Washington's assassination of Qasem Soleimani brutal, arbitrary, unjust, and unlawful. He told the UN Council the United States had committed an international crime of grave nature and must be held to account. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. Bar and nightclub owners in Juba complain business is down as many patrons stay away for fear of contracting the coronavirus. Bar owner Solomon Tekle says many regulars and potential customers are practicing social distancing by staying home. But another bar owner says he's operating at a loss and worries about the future. And young David Mayar reports from Juba.
Loud music blasts at the Samar bar as a handful of customers drink beer and whiskey. Samar manager Solomon Tekle says his place used to be full, but now he gets two or three customers a night.
Most people, they want to protect themselves at lockdown home. So even if the bar is working, people, they cannot come because of the fear, the disease, the virus. So as I say, the business of the bar is not like before. It's completely down. Everybody can see.
In March, the former high-level task force for COVID-19 announced several measures to prevent the spread of the virus, including closing down all bars, schools, churches, and shops selling non-essential items. In May, the task force eased some restrictions, including allowing bars to reopen. But bar and nightclub owners say people are not coming out because they are afraid of contracting the coronavirus. Buliak, who owns a bar in Juba's Shirkat neighborhood, says he is operating at loss and worries about the future of his business.
As my business is slowing down, the landlord is not slowing down. He's demanding me, he's telling me, you have to bring my money at the end of the month. Where will I get that money to pay the rent? So if it continues like this, I'm really worried.
Yak says he used to see more than 50 customers on weekends and make the equivalent of about $15 a day. Yak says these days he hardly earns 1,000 South Sudanese pounds. Nightclubs also say the same is true for their business. Lucky owner of the South Sudan Artists Union, which runs the signature nightclub at Juba's Nyakrun Cultural Center, says since the government suspended public gathering, they have not been able to reopen for business.
It's been a very hard time for us now, as we, the Artists Union, and as the artists of the Republic of South Sudan. It is becoming too hard for us to survive, Zato, due to coronavirus. Some people got kids. Some other people, they got families. Some other people, they got something to do. They got rent. And they cannot manage to pay the bill. Because concerts are where our money come from.
Onar says the Artists Union's main source of livelihood largely depends on bars and nightclubs operating at full capacity. Nyambura Kenyi, Secretary General of the South Sudan Artists Union, is urging the government to support nightclubs and other youth entertainment centers.
Nightclubs actually are not working currently now, and from now we still urge the government that they see to see the issue of the artists, because even we go to humanitarian affairs, we are not getting any food. So people are relying on the music to get to feed their family and to do other things that they want to do, rents and all those things.
Proprietors of bars located inside well-known hotels, including Dembech, Palm Africa and Afex, say they are also struggling to recover after the lockdown. None of the hotel bar managers agreed to be recorded, but a spot check at various Juba hotels bars revealed no more than two or three customers. Some Juba residents say they are now staying away from bars and nightclubs because they do not have money to spend. Resident James Owar says he used to visit a bar and drink with friends, but not anymore.
Actually suffering because the money we are getting, we need support for you to buy something like alcohol. That's the only consumer at home with their children. Going to buy will be a problem because of the money.
As of last Sunday, South Sudan health officials recorded 2,093 confirmed cases of COVID-19, 649 people who recovered, and 40 deaths. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
Fans of the Rolling Stones may get satisfaction in knowing the group plans to release a new version of their 1973 album, Goat's Head Soup, with three unheard tracks. One of the new tracks is called Scarlet and features Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page. The album is coming out on September 4th. The Stones released a video for one of the unheard songs called Crisscross. Goat's Head Soup features one of the band's well-known acoustic ballads as well, Angie. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you don't go to school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during